This podcast is a presentation of UCTV.tv, University of California Television. Like what you learn? Help others discover UCTV podcasts by leaving a comment or rating in iTunes.
Okay, it's now my pleasure to introduce our highlight speaker, keynote address speaker, Dr. Greg Mineta, who was this year's Binkley Professor at UCSF. And it's really an honor and a pleasure to introduce Greg, who probably needs no introduction here since he's been a leader in vascular surgery on the West Coast for three decades. Greg is a graduate of Harvard Medical School, did his surgery training and fellowship training at the University of Washington, and then landed under Dr. Porter at Oregon in the late 1980s and has been there ever since, where he rose in the ranks, rose regionally, rose nationally to be the chief of the service and a leader in vascular surgery across many arenas. We know Greg for his expertise in many clinical areas, peripheral artery disease and critical limb ischemia, venous disease, non-invasive vascular diagnosis, carotid disease. He is a scholar. He's an editor of the Yearbook of Vascular Surgery. He's been that editor for some time. He's an editor, assistant editor of many of our journals, and he's an educator. He's also a prolific author and researcher. He's authored more than 400 publications and chapters and has given many, many invited presentations. But what many of you may not know or may know is how insightful of a thinker he is, how clear of a thinker he is, and how that helps in so many areas of vascular surgery, for example, in writing clinical practice guidelines and developing consensus around evidence and helping us to think straight when we have so many options in front of us. And so it's been a pleasure to work with Greg on some of those things. And I'm really excited that he's with us today and is going to spend a couple of days with us here at the symposium. And I'm excited about his talk because he's going to tell us about how vascular surgeons are an essential resource in our hospitals. Greg.
Well, thank you. Just like last night or yesterday, I work with Dr. Conti, but I actually work for Dr. Conti in most of these things that we work together on. So, my topic today is why we are important, not just to our patients, but to a variety of other things that matter, our hospitals, our operating rooms, and our people in our region, other hospitals in our region. I don't have any disclosures except to say that this comes from the perspective of a person that has worked, spent his entire career in an academic medical center like Oregon or UCSF, both depicted here. So these are large institutions that have certain problems that are unique to these institutions, but also they're common to everybody. So what I'm going to talk to you today about is why we're important, and it has several things that we need to mention. First of all, the separation of general and vascular surgery, hospital economics, our relationships with our colleagues, and our relationships with referring hospitals. Now, last year, the Binkley professor was Dr. Perler. And Dr. Perler was president of the SVS last year. And if you heard his talk at the meeting, you know that he gave a very interesting presidential address. It had a lot of personal anecdotes in it. But he really emphasized the commitment of vascular surgeons to their patients and the satisfaction of providing care to these patients, and the value of what we do to the patients. But if you look in the literature, there's some question of whether we're really happy with all of this. In fact, if you look at things that associate with surgeons being unhappy, one of them was subspecialty choice of vascular surgery, along with private practice and being on call more. So why are vascular surgeons potentially unhappy? Does it have to do with our relationships with our hospital administration? Now, these are my administrators. I actually know all these guys personally quite well, and they're really nice guys out of the hospital, sometimes difficult to deal with in the hospital, but they have a different perspective, and I feel it's my job sometimes to educate them on their proper perspective. We also think about our surgical colleagues. Some of them work less hours than we do, make more money than we do, and perhaps or have more high profile than we do. But the help wanted sign is also out from our small hospitals in our region of what we can do for them. So as all you all remember, vascular surgery and general surgery have been intertwined from the beginning. In fact, all of the great pioneers in vascular surgery, had a background in general surgery. Those with femoral popliteal bypass, abdominal aortic reconstruction, all of these individuals were primarily general surgeons to begin with. Even Dr. DeBakey would still take out a colon late in his life. So general surgery background and vascular surgery were closely intertwined. But now, in the last decade and a half, the roads have diverged. There's no question about that. And the reason for that begins here in San Francisco, I think, with Dr. Wiley, who at some point advocated that we needed to have additional training, and additional training would lead to better results. So at this point, we then started having vascular fellowships. The first one was here at San Francisco with Mac Perry as the first fellow, I believe. And Dr. Wiley himself had the first certificate of special competence in vascular surgery. If you go up the coast a little bit, another big contributor to the divergence was in Portland, Dr. Dotter, and the emergence of angioplasty, along with his friend Bill Cook, with development of catheters and wires. So these two guys actually, on the West Coast, really have caused the split with vascular and general surgery, in my opinion. Now, if you also look at what's going on in the training world, general surgery residents are doing 40% less vascular cases over the last decade or so than they had in the past, whereas vascular surgery residents are doing 160% more cases than they used to do. Now, of course, this is largely driven in the vascular surgical world by catheter-based techniques of diagnostic angiograms and peripheral interventions and EVAR. But the point is that general surgery residents are doing almost none of these things, almost zero, basically. If you look at the open abdominal aortic cases for general surgery residents, they're down by 80%. Of course, vascular surgery residents are also down, but a smaller percentage. Bypass operations for general surgery residents down 60%, up 8% for vascular residents. Carotids down almost 50% for general surgery residents. For vascular residents, up 12%. So general surgeons are not getting trained in vascular techniques anymore, certainly not endo, and only marginally in open procedures. And that trend this trend that's depicted here is not likely to change, I think, over the next time. And what about money? Let's think about this. At my university, our operating budget for fiscal year 2016 was $2.2 billion. On that amount of revenue, we made $125 million in margin, or so-called, which is a euphemism for profit in our nonprofit hospital. But that's what it is. Of that money that came into the hospital, that $2.2 billion, almost $400 million of it came from the Knight Cardiovascular Institute, which I'm a member of. So cardiovascular diseases produced a very large percentage of the overall money to the hospital. Now, what's important to recognize is that only a small percentage of that is professional fees. The overwhelming majority of it is facility fees. The hospital is getting all the money for all the work we do, more than 90% of it. We need to make these guys aware of this. So, now, there was an interesting analysis from the University of Pennsylvania a few years ago. And this is not our data, but this Penn, data from Penn, but what I want to emphasize is the way of thinking that these people present here. And, of course, they wanted to study the relationship between hospital margin and RVU production. And it's a complicated relationship because margin and professional fees generated is not very straightforward relationships because each specialty has different amounts of OR time, different amounts of RVUs per case, and perform different numbers of operations per year. Again, margin is basically a euphemism for profit, and it's revenue minus costs. And there's revenues can come from all different sources. And these guys were pretty successful in looking at pre-admission testing, payments for operative service, and payments for post-operative care, not way down the line, but in the hospital. And then direct costs, of course, are nursing costs, OR costs, facility costs, and indirect costs includes our administrator's salary. Now, they did their analysis by not focusing on dollars, but for privacy reasons, to focus on what was called margin units. And they did this by indexing to neurosurgery, where neurosurgery was the top at 1 million margin units. Then they calculated relative hospital margin or profit per RVU for each specialty and per case and by time in the OR. So this is where we stand. Again, neurosurgery was the highest. They had the most RVUs, transplant a lot of RVUs, cardiac, thoracic, and vascular surgery also was in that top group, way above many other services, such as colorectal surgery, trauma, oncology surgery, otolaryngology, urology, even orthopedics. We produced more RVUs and more contribution to the margin of the hospital than any of those other services. Now, if you look at it, you can see this is the average number of RVUs per service, and the cases here. And what you can see is that our relative hospital margin is really not related to number of cases, because some cases are more complicated than others. They generate different levels of profit per case for a hospital. So just because you do a lot of cases doesn't necessarily mean you contribute a lot to the hospital margin. There is some relationship, however, between the annual RVU production by each surgical division and the relative hospital margin. The big winner, of course, is neurosurgery with a lot of RVUs and a lot of contribution to margin. Transplant also is a big player in this. Vascular surgery exists right here. We do slightly less than the average number of RVUs, but we contribute more than average to the hospital margin. So in essence, we're kind of an efficient service in that way. We don't have to work as much to produce more for the hospital. If you look at here, the time in the OR, again, the efficient groups are here. Transplant, thoracic surgery, and vascular surgery. Less RVUs, less time in the OR, but more contribution to margin. So vascular surgeons are an efficient revenue producer for hospitals. They take less time, less cases to do it than other services. Some people are clear losers, like these individuals over here. So ortho, GYN, I mean, these guys do a lot of cases. They spend a lot of time in the operating room, but they don't help much with the profit for the hospital. And these guys are even worse losers. Not many cases and very little profit for the hospital. We are actually in the good group up here. So we're important to these hospitals, and we just got to get them to think about that in that way. Now, what about our colleagues? Again, some of them have a little more higher profile jobs than we do. A lot of them make more money than we do. But, oops, what happened there? Oops. But again, vascular surgery and general surgery diverged. And our colleagues have always got the help wanted sound out, as far as I can tell. This is from a building in Afghanistan, but we need help, it says, and it applies to the operating room as well. What we did is in our institution, I got tired of listening to how valuable all these other people were, and I said, well, wait a minute, they can't do their job without us. So our thought was that the vascular surgeons provide assistance with a lot of non-vascular procedures. And the frequency and nature of intraoperative consultations really was not very well quantified previously in the literature. And hospital administrators are really not aware of how much we help all these other programs that may be a little higher profile than what we are. In addition, we have to think about this all in the background of our training exposure to complex open surgeries. So what we decided to do was to look at the frequency and nature of intraoperative consults that are performed by vascular surgeons. And this was a period of about 8 years in our university where we did 225 intraoperative consults in support of non-vascular operations. Now, these are a very select group of cases that we're looking at here. These were all cases where the vascular surgeon was called to the operating room by a non-vascular surgeon. We excluded patients all we did is provide advice but didn't technically participate. We excluded cases where we knew about the problem ahead of time when we were actually a co-surgeon already listed and we participated in planning the operation. We excluded spine exposures and we excluded anesthesia or cath lab complications, all of which we also help with. What we looked at primarily was whether this was an expected problem. In other words, somebody might have said, stop by that morning and say, I'm doing this today. I might get in trouble. Can you kind of be aware? Or it was completely unexpected, and all of a sudden you get a call in the middle of your clinic, you got to come to the operating room. And we looked at seeing whether we asked to help with bleeding, dissection, or reconstruction of what vessels were involved and where he needed to be, how much blood loss was involved, and how many RVUs this produced. So these are different patients than a usual vascular patient, not as much coronary disease, not as much diabetes, less smoking, but some of them are still pretty fat, and a lot of them have had previous operations. Many have cancer. The major consulting services in our institution for us was surgical oncology, followed by urology, orthopedics, and a variety of other people. How often do we really have any idea whether we're going to be called that day and have our day interrupted? It was only about 20% of the time. Most of the time, 80% of the time, we had no blooming idea that these guys were going to need us. None at all. And 14% of the time, they needed you right then. You know, finger was in the dike or something, I don't know. But now, what were the reasons they called? Bleeding, reconstruction, and dissection, all pretty much equally distributed. A lot of these people get in trouble. They just really need a good surgeon to dissect around the blood vessels because they're nervous doing that. Where is the principal problem? It's in the abdomen. That's where you spend most of your time on these problems. But it's scattered everywhere, in the chest, in the legs, and in the neck as well. What in vessels? It's pretty much equally distributed between arteries and veins all over the place. So it's going to be all variety of things that you have to deal with. Now, these are big operations in general. The mean blood loss total is about 2 liters. The vascular-associated blood loss in these cases was 327 milliliters. These are long operations, 8 hours. Vascular RVUs, about 31 per case. Non-vascular RVUs, 46 per case. So it's complicated long procedures we get involved with. They spent time in the ICU, a long time in the hospital, and 6.2% of them died, although none of them died intraoperatively, postoperatively. Overall survival, again, given the cancer predominance of these patients, was only about 50% at 5 years. Now, the next year, actually, the Northwestern group looked at the same thing and published in JAMA Surgery. We had published ours in JBS. And they looked at patients from 2010 to 2014. Now, they excluded trauma patients and those with IV filters. And they did include spine exposures in their series, which was the large majority of the patients that they were called to help with. Of course, we excluded them from ours. Now, their mean age of their patients was about 56 years. These types of things provided about 7% of their operative volume, and their RVUs were about 21 per case. And 75% of the time, they knew ahead of time that they were going to have to do this, as opposed to us, it was only 20% of the time. Their major consulting services were neurosurgery and orthopedics, again, reflecting the spine exposure predominance of their series. But then again, also urology and surgical oncology were the big players, just like in our place. Again, the major place where they were was in the abdomen, if you consider the spine exposure to be part of an abdominal procedure, pretty much the same with us, but without spines. Vascular repairs that they had to perform, bypasses, patch angioplasties, primary repairs. I think somewhat less complicated group of patients, but still all requiring the assistance of a vascular surgeon. Again, pretty much equally distributed between arteries and veins that were needed to be addressed. When they had to do a vascular repair, that was more emergent. All their repairs, just like ours, were open. There were no endovascular repairs in these patients. 99% of the cases started before 6 p.m., but a few extended afterwards. Now, USC jumped on the bandwagon at last year's Western Vascular Meeting. And they reported 76 intraoperative consults over 3 years. They also excluded spines, and about 60% of their patients were unplanned where they didn't know about it ahead of time. A slightly different, they had most of their consults were coming from cardiac surgery for some reason, but again, urology, orthopedics, and other services were involved. Primary reasons for consultation, again, are pretty much the same, equally distributed between hemorrhage, exposure, and reconstruction. So even at USC, they need help with some dissections. The distribution of vascular repairs, again, almost all are open techniques, with a very few endovascular techniques were appropriate for these patients. Their mean vascular RVUs were about 23, similar to Northwestern, a little lower than the cases we were involved with. Their mortality was a little higher, 9%, primarily related to the fact that they had 5 patients that died with ECMO-related deaths. And we at this time did not have ECMO in our hospital. We do now, but we didn't then. Now, what about trauma? So trauma is another issue. So major vascular injuries are relatively infrequent. There's actually no formal requirement for a trauma center vascular surgeons, but it's now very uncommon for general or trauma surgeons to repair major vascular injuries. In our hospital, they'll call us the ligate a vein. They won't even ligate veins on their own anymore. And why is that? Well, you think about it, there's very little vascular exposure for general surgeons, and there's really almost no vascular trauma exposure, with the average trauma cases of 3 to 5 for a finishing general surgery resident. That's not very much. Iatrogenic trauma is also something to think about. We looked at a series of 252 patients who had required intervention for vascular trauma, equally distributed between penetrating and blunt, but 1/3 of them were doctor-induced injuries. So we have almost as many traumatic injuries from inside the hospital as outside. And of course, most of those come from percutaneous interventions and some from intraoperative problems. Now, one other thing to consider is how do we help our little hospitals around the state? So we looked at our transfer center records over about a 12-month period, where we had 235 requests for transfer to our vascular surgical service from somewhere in Oregon, southern Washington, eastern Washington, northern California, Idaho, all over the place. And of those 235 requests for transfer, 154 were actually transferred. The primary reasons for transfer were acute and chronic limb ischemia, symptomatic carotid stenosis, ruptured aneurysms, and symptomatic aneurysms. Transfers come from both little hospitals, middle-sized hospitals, and big ones, relatively equally distributed between those with less than 100 beds, 100, 200 beds, and 300 beds, about the same number of transfer requests from all of them. Now, not everybody gets transferred. The reasons vary. 35% stay at the referring facility of the non-transferred patients after we consulted with them and just sort of reassured them they really didn't need to be transferred. 30% were offered a clinic referral at the initial call. 11% received further evaluation locally on the advice of the surgeon. And ultimately, 60% of these patients found their way to our university clinic, even if they weren't transferred at the time of the initial call. Now, 72% of completed transfers resulted in a procedure, 20% within 8 hours, 12% within 8 to 24 hours, and 65% at some time during this admission. Non-surgical interventions generally consisted of medical care for these patients and anticoagulation of the ones who did not get a procedure. Now, large hospitals were actually more likely to transfer patients that required a procedure than smaller ones. For some reason, I'm not sure why, but that was because there were actually pretty much equally the same numbers from all of them. No patient died during transfer or as a direct result of transfer. The mortality of the transferred patients was 12%, 0% for intact aneurysms, 14% for ruptured aneurysms, and there was no difference in transfer time or time from first call to arrival in the hospital in the surviving versus non-surviving patients. So in summary, vascular surgery has effectively separated from general surgery. General surgeons are no longer receive meaningful training in vascular procedures, and as a result of fellowship training and emergence of endovascular procedures. Vascular procedures provide a greater return on investment than most other surgical specialties in terms of hospital revenue. Vascular surgeons enable multiple other specialties to perform complex procedures, primarily through our open technical skills, not our endovascular skills, our open technical skills. Most intraoperative consults are performed for patients with cancer, and many have had previous operations. Most of these things are not anticipated. It really interrupts your day to have to deal with these. They equally involve vascular reconstruction, assisting with hemorrhage control, and interestingly, just being a good surgeon and being able to do a difficult dissection. Abdominal approaches are most often needed. And endovascular techniques for these things are really almost never needed. So transfers are also safe with this relatively low associated mortality, and they're equally distributed among small, medium, and large hospitals. Nearly three-fourths of completed transfers will result in performance of a procedure or a surgical intervention of some sort, and 60% of transfer consultations that are not transferred will eventually result in a patient in your clinic. So my recommendation is, I argue with our hospital all the time, is that hospitals need to support us to facilitate both elective and emergent support for referring institutions and non-vascular specialties and programs, some of which are higher profile than us, but are very essential to the hospital's bottom line, not only us, but them as well. And vascular surgery residents training programs need to ensure adequate training exposure to open complex abdominal operations and difficult dissections, because otherwise there's going to be nobody else to do these things for our colleagues. The help wanted sign is always out. Thank you very much. Take any questions if you like.
Greg, thank you. That was just outstanding. I think everybody in the room is quite familiar with our role as being the fireman in the OR in most of the places where we work, but also familiar with measuring the impact of that. And when you're starting to look at, for example, and I'm interested to hear from others in the room who may be working in community hospitals or anywhere, you're trying to look at manpower for vascular surgeon and how you support that, what the value of that is, for example, at a new hospital or at an affiliated hospital. And people typically start looking at a business plan that starts with RVUs and professional fees. And I used to think that taking call and covering a place where you do your primary work is part of the job of being the surgeon, but obviously then as you're starting to extend yourself, there should be some value to just being available. But the question I'm asking really is how do you, you know, if it's not just professional fees, and when you're trying to negotiate or figure out the value of staffing another place or of adding a vascular surgeon to your place when you're not even measuring all the other things that get done, all the curbsides to look at a CAT scan for this or that, or, you know, is this going to be a problem, or there's so many other things that we do. How do those conversations go, and how do you decide how many people might be needed, even though you don't have maybe the knowledge of how many vascular cases and how many profi and how much profi dollars they're going to generate, and who's going to pay for that non-professional part?
Well, I think the first thing to remember is that looking at just professional fees is a myopic approach, you know, because most of the money that comes out of vascular procedures has nothing to do with professional fees. It's all the technical stuff. Now, the other issue is that, of course, is that I'm recruiting physicians for smaller hospitals now, and you can't get somebody to work, go down. You can't get one surgeon to work in a hospital. You can't even get two. Nobody wants to be on call once every night or every other night. It's very difficult to even get people to consider every third night anymore. Young people don't want to do that. It seems like the minimum is every fourth night. So somehow you have to find a way to provide call for those, backup call for those patients or those individuals. And the hospitals need to understand that for a while they are building their programs, they're going to pay a surgeon to breathe, basically. And that's part of the reality. It's just what it is. The problem is that surgeons aren't generally happy just breathing. They want to do work. So what I think for us, what we're trying to do is we'll continue to provide call for these small hospitals remotely. You know, we'll take advice calls. And you can transfer those patients on certain nights. But as your program grows, maybe you won't have to do that as much, and then you can actually have another one there. But it's I don't think you can just take and just have a simple solution to this. All the five hospitals I'm supposed to be recruiting surgeons for now, every single one of them is going to need a different solution. Some of them have more money than others. Some of them have nicer place to live than others. Every solution is going to be different. I'm not sure what they all are. The one thing that's very clear is that we're worth a lot more than we generate in professional fees, both, you know, in money and in terms of our relationships to our colleagues and, of course, our patients, as Bruce pointed out in his SVS address. Yes, thank you. Hi.
do we have time for another quick question? So thank you. That was really interesting. And you discussed a lot of the economic points in the equations and everything. But some of it might be also coming from the organizational culture in terms of making the surgeons happy. So what are suggestions, actually, that you would tell the hospital administrators in terms of making this better, and even if there's no change in terms of the amount of money or some of these other factors mentioned, that make how can they make it better?
Well, one of the lines I use is that and the administrators generally understand economics, and I say that, you know, there's a lot more jobs than there are vascular surgeons. So this is a market. You can think of this as a marketing thing. You've got limited resource and a lot of demand for it. You're going to have to pay for it. Sometimes you may have to pay more than you want to. But if you don't, you won't have it. So in our place, quite frankly now, it's very difficult for vascular surgeons to make their salaries just on their professional fees. It's very difficult. So hence the employment model. Because, again, you're in demand. So you can negotiate up your wage. And some hospitals have figured that out, and others are a little slower to come around. But if people start leaving, then they come around a lot quicker. Or they threaten to leave, they come around quicker.
Thank you.
So those are all things you bring to the table when you discuss this. The most important thing is for them to come to grips with the fact that there's a lot of downstream revenue that's not in a professional fee. That's very important to their bottom line. Yes.
So I think it's very interesting when you show the roads dividing, and for those of us in the generation who were the straight road and right, the division was really the endovascular part. Fast forward, I don't know about your institution, but a lot of places are looking at training vascular surgeons. And going, and certainly in most places, no vascular surgeon is going to be doing general surgery anymore. Absolutely. Given the limited number of open procedures, is there really a future for somebody doing 6 or 7 years of general surgery and then 2 or 3 more? Or should the leadership be saying, time to go to a single 5-year or 6-year training program for vascular surgeons?
I don't really know the answer to that. It's the trainees will tell us the answer, what they want. I think you're still going to need somebody that knows how to deal with difficult procedures, whether a vascular surgeon or a surgical oncologist or general surgeon. I don't know who they are, but it's got to be somebody. Currently, in many places, it's still the vascular surgeon, I think. Maybe not the young ones, but the older guys. I try in my place. I have younger surgeons, not as many as I'd like, but I try to get them involved with these bad cases because when I'm gone, they're going to have to do it. So yeah. Somebody's going to have to do it, or we just can't let the patients die or have major complications because there's nobody who knows how to do it. When it's possible to have somebody who knows how to do it. And not every place is going to be able to do all these cases, because if you don't have backups, you probably shouldn't be doing these things. If it occurs regularly enough that you're going to have problems. So for instance, if your spine surgeon every once in a while gets into the aorta, you got to have somebody who can fix that rapidly. So. All right, well, thank you very much.
You've been listening to a podcast by University of California Television. For more information about this program or UCTV, visit us online at uctv.tv.